Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your very favorite weekly libertarian podcast from the magazine of Free Minds and Free Markets. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Good morning, everyone.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
See? We can all hit our lines. A couple of weeks ago on this very program, our editor-in-chief, Catherine Mangu Ward, aforementioned, pointed out that despite all the domestic political commentary to the contrary, the Israel-Hamas war is not fundamentally about us, meaning the United States and America. Well, last week kind of challenged that notion with the historic visit to wartime Tel Aviv by President Joseph Robinette Biden. Biden, over the course of about 36 hours last week, flew to Israel, met with the prime minister and war cabinet there, had other bilateral meetings with leaders from Jordan and Egypt and Qatar canceled over Arab outrage over a deadly explosion at a Gaza hospital that was initially blamed on Israel. He expressed full rhetorical empathy for Israel's loss and support for Israel removing Hamas in Gaza, while cautioning at the same time against making the same kind of policy mistakes that America made after 9/11, including a lengthy post-war occupation. Biden advocated on behalf of the estimated 10 now American hostages still held in Gaza. He tried to pry open the blockaded border crossing with Egypt for the exchange of refugees and humanitarian supplies. Along the way, he uttered the phrase, "I am a Zionist," and also told the same shaggy dog story about Golda Meir approximately 73 times. Biden then flew back home, gave an Oval Office address to the American people, asking for more and continued support both for Israel and Ukraine. A pretty active schedule for an old feller. The American military, which intercepted some long-range missiles and drones from the Houthi-controlled chunk of Yemen being a really good band name last week, is rushing to the region more missile defense capabilities and naval assets as part of its two aircraft carrier strike groups, plus an amphibious ready group. Another good ska band name. Iranian-backed forces have been harassing American holdings in Iraq and Syria. Street protests in Tunisia and Jordan and Lebanon have targeted U.S. diplomatic outposts. And now, as of this morning, which is Monday, reports are coming out that the U.S. is urging Israel to slow its role on a ground invasion, to give more time to hostage negotiations, and also perhaps to avoid rushing headlong toward a potential regional war. Nick, you are generally not a fan of our real American genius in the White House. How do you assess that Uncle Joe did last week? And what is your current feeling about the administration's response to the October 7th massacre?
Let me compartmentalize it into a couple things. The things that I found in his speech in particular, which was something like only the second Oval Office address that he's given, which was kind of surprising to realize, but, you know, I guess maybe presidents don't do that anymore. But he hammered hard on the idea that the United States was the indispensable nation in the verbiage of Madeleine Albright. I think that's wrong, and it's terrible as a guide to foreign policy or trade policy or any kind of policy whatsoever. And that I found more than problematic. I dislike that intensely. And I also found that his wrapping of the Ukraine aid in with the aid to Israel to be politically brilliant, but you got to be a little bit cynical about that as well. Having said that, I want to actually say I thought Joe Biden's comment or his speech from the Oval Office hit a couple of real, dingers, Matt, that I thought were really fantastic. And one is that he absolutely characterized the Hamas terrorism for what it was, which was terrorism and barbarism, which Israel has an absolute right to defend itself against. I thought that was, incredible and absolutely right. But the main thing from an American point of view is his characterization of our response to 9/11 when he said to Israel, "Do not make the mistake that we made, because we screwed up after 9/11. We overreacted at home and abroad." And, you know, this is coming from a guy who was in the Senate when this stuff was happening, and he voted for every major escalation of invasion and of military force and of domestic surveillance and things like that. And then he perpetuated these stupid wars as vice president. You know, I think that's an important thing. And that was what I, you know, found most, you know, important about what he was talking about. The other thing that I actually liked was when he addressed the American people and he said, you know, don't be anti-Semitic and don't be anti-Islamic at the same time. You know, people talk about the White House or the presidency as having a bully pulpit. It rarely gets used, actually. And I think Biden, in a way, actually was delivering the right message on those limited issues. And I was happy to see that. There's a lot wrong with that. There's a lot wrong with our foreign policy still and things like that. But I think Joe Biden's, you know, empathy, not just for Israelis, but also for Palestinians, you know, is right. I think his critique of American foreign policy and domestic policy after 9/11 is absolutely important. And I was happy to hear that. And also his absolute assertion, which will be dismissed the minute he needs to change it. But when he said there are not going to be ground troops, American troops in Israel, you know, I think that's also good. This was in many ways an excellent example of what a presidential speech should look like.
I think there are not going to be ground troops. There's just going to be special forces. That's a really important distinction that is lost on everybody because it's kind of ridiculous.
Advisors.
Advisors.
We call
everywhere.
Them advisors.
Special advisors.
To extend and revise, not revise, but amend slightly Nick's remarks, which I largely associate myself with, Biden's track record, indeed, as advertised, but I think as vice president, there's a fair amount of reporting that he was one of the loudest voices for restraint about U.S. foreign policy, particularly in terms of the possible, which almost happened, U.S. airstrikes in Syria. There was a sense in which Biden had that kind of like, oh, we screwed up in Iraq. We screwed up. That was expressed within the Obama administration, which I think is kind of interesting and perhaps informs him getting out of Afghanistan, which is kind of interesting. And the other thing is on I also agree with Nick about the welcomeness of the remarks, reminding Americans to not yield to the worst angels of their nature domestically. The thing that rubbed me a little bit wrong about that is that he, I think, overemphasized how allegedly badly Americans behaved in 9/11 towards our Islamic and unfortunately, in many cases, Sufi or not even Sufi, Sikhs. Thanks. All the S's. Come on. People, I think Americans had a much better track record than initially advertised, but these are quibbles. Catherine, let's pick up on the indispensable nation stuff. JD Too Chilly, whose Slack name is represented by two little comical chilies, which I just think is really cute. This morning had a piece titled U.S. Faces Risks in Spreading Israel-Hamas Conflict. Americans are likely to be blamed no matter what happens, which, yes, this is true. Can I put upon you, and I shouldn't, but I'm going to. Can you sketch out like a 30,000-foot vision of like what the ideal Catherine Mangue Ward libertarian vision for the U.S. involvement in the Middle East might look like?
Really?
And yeah. And and like what would happen if we suddenly started doing that tomorrow?
Yeah, Catherine, I'm actually really curious. What should America's foreign policy be?
Yeah, like all of it.
Give it to me in podcast length answer.
It's no problem. I'm ready. So I'll start by saying I also shockingly was like, oh, Joe Biden mostly didn't do anything horrible last week, which was not a given. So kudos to him. You know, I think I grew up with this kind of image that, you know, Bill Clinton or maybe somebody else was going to bring to the negotiating table the players in the Middle East. It was probably going to be at Camp David, right? Like everyone was going to be there in their we're doing serious diplomacy in our khakis mode, and that was what was going to bring peace in the Middle East. Like I sort of had that casual assumption as a youthful 90s reader of Time and Newsweek, and yes, yes, that's what I said, and that's who I was, so suck it. But the that didn't work.
That is U.S. News and World Report erasure.
It is, actually. And as someone who was an intern there once, I shouldn't have done that. Okay. Anyway, it is not about me, much like it is not about the United States. This is what I want to say here, that this notion that like all that really needed to happen was like a good faith broker or someone to bring everyone to the table, and that these were sort of solvable differences using the tools of conventional diplomacy. I think that's just not the case, right? Like, I think a sort of reasonable approach to the Middle East involves accepting that these are intractable differences and that they are going to be settled with violence. And I hate that. We hate that. This is very bad news for everyone. But humans are like that sometimes. As a preview of my Wachu later in the podcast, I went to the Asian Art Museum this weekend and was struck by how much of that art is informed by conquest in the Middle East. And so I think that America's role is nothing. America's role is nothing. Like I'm not generally, like, my focus is not on non-interventionism. That is not where my libertarianism originates. That is not like the beating heart of my personal kind of political philosophy. But these are conflicts that even the most well-informed in the United States can't understand at a visceral level. And they are visceral. They are deeply felt. There just isn't a meeting brokered by a U.S. president that's going to resolve this.
Peter, I know that almost nothing scares you more than your own shadow, but the thing that does is the scenario of impending global thermonuclear war. So what is your current most plausible, not great Bob scenario in the Middle East?
So we've talked about the Biden speech, but there was another Biden administration official who went on the record last week, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, who was asked, hey, so it seems like America has some real fiscal problems. Debt's real high. It's going to keep being very high. It's going to get higher, right? Like, where the deficit problem is, like, the deficit has basically doubled just in the last year, which is the year after Biden spent, you know, a whole bunch of time bragging about how his administration had brought it down. Seems like there's maybe not enough money just to do the stuff that you're already planning to do. Can you afford another war? And Janet Yellen was like, yes, absolutely. We can definitely afford another war. Folks, we cannot afford another war. And that brings me to the answer to your question, Matt, which is, if we could get drawn into this, maybe we don't have ground troops, maybe we don't even have advisors or special forces, but if we are spending an awful lot of money to back Israel militarily and to be maybe not the world's policeman, but the world's bullet supply store, where we're just constantly sending munitions to Ukraine and to Israel and spending a lot of money to do so, and then also spending a bunch of money on, you know, moving naval armaments, right, ships and that sort of thing into the region. And we are not in the war, but we are standing at the precipice of the war. We are sort of gazing on it from right next. We are war adjacent. Well, the war could expand and get more expensive and more complicated. And the war in Ukraine could become, could keep going. And that could provide an opportunity for, say, China to invade Taiwan. And then what happens? Because we are committed officially, formally, and on the record to defending Taiwan. And then we end up in a kind of a three-front war. And can we afford a three-front war? Is Yellen's answer that we can do that? And so my worry here is partly just about nuclear weapons and about nuclear exchange always, because there's nothing worse. That's the quickest path to actual apocalypse. But my medium term, my interim worry is that the United States ends up bogged down in two quasi-wars and one maybe actual war with China, which is a great power that has a military that is formidable, that would actually pose a real challenge to the United States. And that would be a terrible, terrible situation to be in. And the kind of rhetoric that we saw from Biden about the United States being the indispensable nation, that is the sort of rhetoric that gets you into big, ugly, unwinnable forever wars all over the world.
I think that the one interesting kind of knife's edge concept going forward is the use of, or the intended use of, all of the naval assets just parked off the coast there as a missile interceptor. Right. Iran has through their proxies, very many long range missiles pointed at Israel from Yemen, certainly from just north of the border in the Hezbollah controlled parts of Lebanon and elsewhere. And the U.S. has already intercepted some missiles, arguably the main way in which the U.S. helps Israel militarily is with the Iron Dome, which is a missile interceptor or a rocket interceptor. And it's not hard to imagine Joe Biden picturing this, because he's pretty much said it, as we are there to tell Iran, and I can't pronounce that word, to not get involved, to not have a Mideast regional war. So the question will be, like, will that work? Will that backfire? And I think that's one of many two or three or four or five different questions right now in which a lot of different things hang. All right, let's talk about the way in which this is about us, which is to say, American politics, particularly during a presidential election cycle, loves to convert the big news story into a lot of really harebrained policy ideas. And Israel versus Hamas is certainly not accepted. Let's go around the table and each of us bring a particularly awful policy proposal triggered by the recent events. Can come from presidential aspirants, so it doesn't necessarily have to. And if you really have a good, like, wow, that was a great policy that was introduced, all ears, kind of, I'm going to take the under on that. But Catherine, do you want to lead us off in a round of a policy proposal that has come up post October 7th that looks a little bit stinky?
Yeah, let's talk about the Gaza Act, the guaranteeing aggressors zero admission act. Yep.
No.
And that is a thing that happened
Holy
last week.
Moly.
This is like sort of the simplest and in many ways the stupidest approach to the legitimately difficult question of what to do about folks who might want to flee that region of the world right now and come to our region of the world. Right now, of course, already our immigration authorities have plenty of power to deny entry to people who are, documented terrorists or really even suspected of being terrorists. This would significantly increase the standards, basically would make holders of passports issued by the Palestinian Authority ineligible for visas, admission, or parole. This is not good. This is a very, very classic example of collective guilt. And, it's a reasonable enough question to say, hey, what can we do to make sure that we don't get, radical Islamic terrorists just rolling up on our shores? But this law is this legislation is crafted instead to punish people who are just regular people who are finally broken by this conflict. I mean, Palestinians who want to leave are under incredible duress. Like, if you are still living in Gaza in 2023, you are there because you are very, very deeply committed to the idea that you should be there, that you need to be there, that justice demands that you are there. And if someone wants to leave now, I am inclined to say that we should do our best to make space for them. There is a proposal in the UK that would make space for refugees, framed very similarly to the way the UK has handled Ukrainian refugees. And I think that that's an interesting model. Nothing has actually passed there, though, as far as I know.
Nick, what's a bad policy that you've seen?
Coming out of the Heritage Foundation, Laura Rees, who is their director of border security and immigration immigration policy, put out a video that Heritage took down, and it was just flatly racist, saying that equating all, anybody who's in Palestine, whether it's the West Bank or Gaza, is in full support of Hamas and butchering people, and they should, we absolutely cannot take in a single refugee or anybody from Gaza. She The video was taken down. Justin Amash, the former congressman who is of Palestinian descent, registered how awful this was. Rightly so. But her op-ed that's based on is still up. We'll put it in the show notes. It is a profound moment when you see a group like the Heritage Foundation, which for a very long time, pushed for a very muscular American foreign policy everywhere, but then is immediately, is now in a Trumpified era, is saying, no, we shouldn't be anywhere except wherever Trump says we should be. But most importantly, we cannot afford to take in anybody from anywhere at any time because everything is full here. And when it comes to Gazans, they're all terrorists. And it is symptomatic of a kind of stupid knee-jerk response to, kind of the contradictions, the internal contradictions of American foreign policy for at least the past 50 years. And it's just grotesque and wrong. And thankfully, it does not reflect what Gazans think. Most of them are not happy with Hamas. This is all going to change as Israel actually begins its ground invasion and things like that. But more fundamentally, from an American point of view, the idea that America cannot take in refugees or asylees from war-torn areas, particularly ones who would be vetted and who would be on board with living in America or, enjoying kind of liberal self-governance, at least for a while. We need a major reboot on that kind of mentality.
I would also add that Congressman Amash, former Congressman Amash, who's a friend of the show, I feel confident stating it forthrightly, sadly lost at least two of his relatives were killed in an Israeli airstrike, whether intentionally or not, probably unintentionally, of an old Orthodox church there, which he announced on Friday. Very sad hearts go out to him. Peter, what is a dumb policy that you've seen in the wake of October 7th?
Over the weekend, Florida governor and Republican presidential hopeful Ron DeSantis tweeted, quote, "When I am president, if foreign students are out there celebrating terrorism, I will cancel their visas and send them home." So earlier this year, we did a live podcast in New York. And Matt, you asked each one of us to make a quick case against somebody who was running for president. And I drew DeSantis. And the argument that I made was that if you look at his most prominent ideas and legislative proposals, the through line is that they are all designed to use the power of the state to stop or squelch speech, especially, but not only, in educational settings. We have seen that with the Stop Woke Act, with his internet law, with the takeover of New College, and this is just more of the same. DeSantis is threatening to use state power to stop the exchange of ideas, to stop expression. And it just represents a fundamental misunderstanding of the First Amendment. The First Amendment does not protect just ideas that are wrong, but you can kind of understand how someone would hold them. It protects expression that is awful, that is offensive, that is deeply repulsive to you. It protects the expression of ideas that you hate the most. And DeSantis just doesn't seem to get that.
Just building on that and agreeing with it vociferously, I will also just register how just off-putting and weird and awful it has been to see, hard for me to mash up words in the morning, people were wandering around New York City, my semi-alma mater, UC Santa Barbara, and elsewhere, tearing down these missing posters of hostages in Gaza. There's more than 200 hostages, 10 of them are America. Why are you tearing them down? What are you doing? What are you doing? It's such a weird move, and it's so widespread, or at least captured a lot on video. It's genuinely puzzling and kind of distressing to me. To answer the question, which is more about policy proposals that are terrible, one I'll go through, which is not a current presidential aspirant, but he wished that he could have won before. Senator Lindsey Graham, one of his first responses to what happened is that cheering on Israel to, quote, level Gaza. This is a bad proposal. It's not a bill yet. I don't think it's going to be. But this is the kind of actually throwback to Heritage Foundation's like hawkish past. This cartoonish yen for violence. One can be absolutely four square in favor of Israel removing Hamas as a governing institution in Gaza, which is going to be an awful bloody way, will by not letting yourself say, I want to level Gaza. These are buildings full of humans. It's going to be awful. It is awful already. There is absolutely no call, no use, no humanity in saying that what we need to do is to just create more rubble where humans live. I understand it's a very complicated dynamic, certainly, and that's has been for a long time, and it is immediately right now. That doesn't help. Lindsay, put a sock in it. All right, we're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, a reminder that this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Friends, do you know the parable or metaphor about the blind man and the elephant? Unsurprisingly, I have never really understood that or at least been able to reproduce it accurately in a conversation. But suffice it to say that being metaphorically blind can be a handicap when encountering the large and difficult to comprehend obstacles that come up on your journey through this electric thing called life. The better you can see, the more clearly you can assess the challenges, and the more colorfully you'll be able to describe massive animals with tusks and trunks. Turning the metaphor back into reality, that's where BetterHelp Online Therapy comes in. BetterHelp is an easy-to-use, super flexible, entirely online therapy service that has helped many listeners of this here podcast see more clearly through the confusions all around us. All you have to do is fill out a quick questionnaire, get matched with a therapist. If you don't like the first one, just swap them out for a second. Let therapy reveal the elephant in the room with BetterHelp. Just visit betterhelp.com/roundtable right now to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right, reminder, please email your short queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Jackie Nyes, I think we pronounced your last name. Hello. As requested, I will try to keep this brief. Thank you, Jackie. I'm having my second child soon. Mazel tov. So maternity leave, or more accurately, the lack of maternity leave, has been on my mind. How should libertarians address the fact that only 25% of Americans have access to paid maternity leave, and roughly only half of Americans are covered by FMLA with their jobs protected while they recover from birth and bond with their baby? I have worked in both red and blue states, and in two out of my four jobs, I was not covered by FMLA and could have been fired as soon as my PTO ran out. I'm just a reader here. Okay, I don't know what these things. I guess my question is actually whether maternity leave will eventually need to be mandated by the government, because it does not seem like employers are interested in covering it voluntarily. And recovering from childbirth and bonding with your baby shouldn't cost you your job and or your financial stability. Thanks, pondering while pregnant. And I appreciate the naming convention at the end there. Catherine, you're a lady. And also, if I'm not mistaken, you're a lady who has instituted workplace maternity leave here at the Reason headquarters, if I understand things correctly, though I think maybe your predecessor made some moves in that regard too. Tell us what we should think about all this.
First of all, Jackie, congratulations on the second baby. The phrasing of the question I have to push back against a little bit, whether maternity leave will eventually need to be mandated by the government because people are not doing the thing that I want them to do, is generally not how I think about these questions. I get it because, you know, for people who do fear for their jobs or, you know, end up going back to work much, much sooner than they would like, definitely sucks. I get it. But I also think that the solution here is not just for the federal government or for any government to say, yeah, employers, you made a bunch of policies about this and presumably thought about them and, you know, dealt with the consequences with respect to your own employees. But we think you did it wrong and we're going to make the rules for you and you have to bear the cost. That is not the right solution because, among other things, it results in, you know, discrimination against women of childbearing age. And I think that that is something that is almost always underconsidered in this debate. If you mandate a very, very generous paid maternity leave policy, employers are going to look twice at recently married women in their late 20s and early 30s before they give them jobs or give them promotions. There's lots of evidence about this pattern playing out in Europe, especially in Germany. And so, you know, I just think the secondary consequences matter a lot, you know, for people who are wishing to see these policies in place, unfortunately, and also fortunately, like, it has to be done at the private level. If we are going to mandate these policies, and there are states that do have sort of backdoor mandates on a bunch of these things, the state should pay for it. Like, I would rather have this be paid for through the annoying but broadly agreed upon democratic process whereby everyone votes for it and then everyone pays for it, rather than the kind of other mechanism whereby you force employers to pay for it against their will. But, you know, I don't think that maternity leave should be mandatorily paid. And that's a bummer. I think it's important and good that Reason covers maternity leave and some paternity leave, but I don't think everyone should have to. That's not how some jobs work.
If these benefits incentivize employers not to hire people, and Matt started this policy, that's what I was picking up. Matt, why do you hate pregnant women? What were you trying to do?
I didn't start the policy. I created a workaround.
Oh, now you're walking it back?
The way that Matt Welsh established maternity leave policy at Reason was that I started to say, hey, Matt, I think I need to talk to you about the fact that I'm going to have a baby and I'm not going to come to work for a while after that. And Matt said, yeah, we'll get to it. And then when I was in labor, I sent an email and said, I'll see you in 12 weeks.
I'll see you in 12 weeks or in court.
Sounds like leadership to me.
The flip side of this, to continue answering the letter writer's concern, though, is also, according to a 2018 story by Veronique DeRougie at Reason, somewhere between 45% to 63% of women reported having access to paid leave. So what has been happening, and in that story, again, in the show notes, what's been happening over the past 20, 30, 40 years is that companies have been moving to, come up with policies that work for them and for their employees. This is not a utopian solution, and there is no such thing, of course, but it's really important and powerful to look at the ways in which markets actually kind of sort these things out. And when they do it kind of organically and things like that, there's more experimentation, so that when policies finally can become widespread, they've worked out a lot of the secondary effects that Catherine was warning against. So it doesn't mean everything is perfect or everything is peachy, but the fact is that we're in a much better place because, and this is, as somebody who managed a lot of people at Reason for a long time, employers generally are desperate to keep good workers. And, it's odd because certainly for the woman, but also, for men who become fathers and things like that, nothing is a bigger life event. I think all of the parents on the podcast would agree. Nothing is bigger as a life event than becoming a parent. It is absolutely earth-changing, world-shattering, all of that kind of stuff. But for employers, it means like if somebody's not going to work for 3 or 6 months, if they're a good employee, you will absolutely put up with that and do whatever you can to keep them in work, coming back to work, being happy, working part-time, whatever you need.
Peter, I wonder, in just hearing this, thinking out loud, God help us, we have in this country the original sin of the way that we administer health insurance is that this is employer-based health insurance. It's the fact that we have this bad kind of system where the employer does health insurance, does that in its own way incentivize less maternity leave? Can you follow me where I'm going with this? Does it make employers look at in the Catherine scenario, women of a certain age to be potential liabilities because they're on the hook for paying them.
I think we call them birthing people now,
yes,
Matt.
Sorry about that.
I think women of a certain age refers to a different certain age usually than childbearing age.
Matt is 1 second away from going full Don Lemon on you, Catherine.
I don't think so. My skincare routine is not nearly as sound. Peter, help us think about this through a health policy wonk lens.
So I haven't seen any evidence to the effect that the tax carve-out for employer benefits actually, which is the reason that most health insurance is provided through employers, here actually makes a difference in terms of maternity leave. But you're onto something generally, which is that when you require paid family leave, it turns mothers into cost centers for employers, right? It just makes them more expensive.
You flatterer, you.
Yeah, sorry. Wow. Right? And it does so in a uniform way that does right across the board. And so what we have seen internationally is that that has fairly predictable economic consequences. And so proponents of paid family leave here in the United States like to say, well, you know, this is very common in other countries. They should look at what has happened in those countries, because in countries like Chile and Spain, which have recently implemented paid family leave policies over the last 20 years or so, you can actually see a before and after effect. And that allows you to run a kind of economic experiment and get data on this. And what you see is that women are paid substantially less in those countries. And there's a very clear and very direct effect that women, that basically employers offset the cost of having to provide the leave by paying women less. And then the other thing that happens is that women end up with fewer promotions and in fewer high-level leadership roles. And so because women are seen as in some sense, cost liabilities, right? Like, oh, this might be a situation where this person can't work for many months and we still have to pay them, then they don't get put in positions where they get to make decisions and where they get to make a lot of money. And what the pitch for these laws is that they free women. And in fact, when you look at the evidence, what happens is they trap women in lower tier jobs that pay less money and have less authority.
And are particularly these sort of unintended consequences are particularly cruel for women who don't want to have kids, or who aren't going to have kids, or who can't have kids. And that to me is like a very, very underappreciated element of these policies. You know, it's one thing for me who absolutely did have babies and take time off and, you know, cost money on health insurance for someone to look at me and see that in terms of the dollar signs. But another thing for my colleagues who don't want to have kids and won't have kids to still be bearing all of those costs. So I think that's something that's worth considering as well. One of the niche legacies of Obamacare is that breast pumps are covered, just like flat. Like you can have one. It is free because the breast pump lobby or just like somebody decided that this should be in the law.
I think that might have been John Stagliano might have been behind that. Producer of Milk Nymphos and Milk Nymphos too.
And I'm sure that it has leveled out some, but this was all relatively new when I had my babies. And the whole process for it was just like a poster child type situation for why having government administer these things is insane. And I think you might well say, hey, you know, in the same way that this letter writer has said, it should be that it doesn't cost you money to feed your baby. Like it should be that you don't have to pay extra just, you know, because you need to pump. There's a lot of shoulds, but you can't always make them embodied in reality and in law.
Matt, at the risk of extending this, but I want to hear you defend your favorite politician of all time, John McCain. He is the last major politician or presidential candidate who actually floated a proposal to get rid of or effectively cancel the tax benefits for healthcare benefits way back when. When
arguably
is that going to happen? Yeah, when are we going to get to a point where people just say, you know what, it was a catastrophic, stupid thing to somehow expect employers to pay for, like to sort through and pay for health insurance as part of a compensation package, or to mandate that? And when can we just get to a place where it's individuals will shop for health insurance, similar to the way that they shop for, car insurance, and take it away from
presidents?
I would
just note that it's not mandatory. What the law did was it provided it made fringe benefits at work basically not taxable. And so that means
this point
that a dollar
now,
of health insurance
employers,
is worth more for you than a dollar of compensation, which provides a strong incentive for employers to provide
at
benefits.
At this point,
like health
Peter,
insurance.
As you well know, like any employer of any size, and there are, you know, various other kinds of add-ons to that original thing where it's effectively mandatory for many, many, if not most employers to offer health benefits. And it's a mistake. So Matt, when is McCain's legacy finally going to bubble up from the lake in which it fell?
it's very evocative language. Arguably, the greatest policy fork in the road or consequence of the McCain versus Obama election is exactly that. So Obama ran on what would eventually become Obamacare, and early on in the process of the formulation of Obamacare, despite the fact, and I think it is a fact, and Peter, you can't interrupt me because it's going to take too much time. I know you. Despite the fact that almost or a huge majority of people, left and right, when they look at what is wrong with the American health system, point to that World War II era kind of scarcity rule on not, because it was the wage cap situation back then. So there's a way to get around it that the employers could offer health benefits. That is the original sin. It's the fatal flaw. And there was a moment in the formulation of Obamacare where, like, should we do something with this? Nah. And then now Obamacare has become a reality. Now Republican politics, led by Donald Trump, has come to sort of defend and extend the welfare state writ large rather than kind of attack it, even though Trump was rhetorically kind of against Obamacare, but he was sort of all over the map. I think that's really difficult. When are we going to get to that point, Nick? Maybe that point was in 2008, and because of a variety of things, most notably the great financial crisis of that fall, Americans chose Obama over McCain. It was McCain's arguably his best idea. I would also say, though, that you can have presidential candidates rhetorically in favor of X if there isn't a large amount of work that's done in that area or that's available through think tanks and other types of political preparation. X is not going to happen, which we saw a lot with the presidency of George W. Bush, who was very much in favor of things like, you know, privatizing aspects of Social Security and immigration reform and such like, which we have written about at great length. And I recommend that people read some of it. Okay, I'm moving on.
He did get tortured past in the first term, though. So, you know, Bush wasn't a complete failure, Matt.
Thank you for recognizing my pain. Let's get to, in brief as possible, fashion, the omni shambles in Washington, D.C. Last week, Ohio Republican and huge freedom caucuser Jim Jordan lost three separate and increasingly embarrassing votes to become the new Speaker of the House of Representatives to replace the ousted Kevin McCarthy, the so-called Bakersfield Comet. Now, there are nine candidates for the Ring of Power. And yes, we're going to call them the Nazgul. I will now read their names in a naked attempt to elicit even more snorting noises from the gallery. House Majority Whip Tom Emmer from Minnesota. Kevin Hearn from Oklahoma. Georgia's Austin Scott. Byron Donalds from Florida. Jack Bergman, he's Quincy.
What's wrong with us?
Or a member of the Houston Astros.
These are just made up names, right?
Mike Johnson from Louisiana. Pete Sessions, apparently still alive, from Texas. Wow. Dan Muser from Pennsylvania. And rounding out the Nazgul, Gary Palmer from the great state of Alabama. Please clap. Let's each bring one takeaway from the ongoing beauties in Washington, D.C. Nick, why don't you start?
I enjoyed Tom McClintock, who also sounds made up, but is in fact not. The very conservative and small government congressman from California wrote a letter thanking them for their duty and that they're all blessed to, you know, his other Republicans are blessed to work with such people.
That was towards the eight people who voted, the Gates eight,
yeah,
who voted to oust the aforementioned Bakersfield comment. Yes,
that was I'm also very disappointed that there weren't more wrestling metaphors in the stories about Jim Jordan's failure, pinned, you know, thrown out of the ring, et cetera. Like,
you have to have the comedic Jim Jordan.
Yeah. That's right. Jim Jordan.
Catherine, what say you about how impressive this has all been?
I associate myself with the headline that I saw on CNN this morning. House GOP circus embarrasses senior party leaders.
Wow.
Which is, it's like, it is, it's just embarrassing at this point. No, I mean, it obviously, it echoes the presidential race, right? Like, we have this party with no thought leadership, with no political leadership.
You didn't need the word leadership there.
The only person who is a like fully realized character is Donald Trump, in just an ocean of like NPCs, like just interchangeable who knows characters. You know, you like walk up to them and they just like start to say their pre-recorded statement and you can like walk away before they're done. It's ridiculous. It's, you know, it shows that this is what happens if a very, very, very old guard stays in power too long and then runs out of juice without any kind of succession planning. And yeah, it's embarrassing.
Peter, you live in Washington, D.C. How are your Republican friends doing? Are they, is it a thousand yard stare or are they just rubbing their hands with glee because they like to watch it all burn?
Well, I make cocktails. You may have heard about this. And so it turns out that Republican staffers like to drink cocktails, especially right now. I'm enjoying this as like a, I'm a big fan of the DC Comics animated universe that ran from about the early 1990s through the mid aughts. And at the very end of that, the guys who created this, Bruce Timm and Paul Dini, created two, a series of shows, first Justice League and then Justice League Unlimited. And in the first one, you just had like six or seven core characters. And in the second one, they were like, oh, we get the whole sandbox, the whole DC universe to play with. And so you had characters like the Elongated Man and like Big Barda. Right. Show it like that's who's running for House Speaker now.
Could you do a Twitter thread where you just map each candidate for speaker onto someone from Justice League Unlimited?
Yeah.
Also using AI. Right. You have to sketch them out.
Right. So one of these guys is obviously Brainiac 5. The thing you left out from your description of what happened last week was not just that Jim Air Jordan didn't become speaker. It's also that they flirted with and then quickly abandoned a plan to basically give the powers to the current temporary speaker, Patrick McHenry. And he is a favorite of the moderates. He's like a guy who's like been in leadership, seems like something close to a normal and ordinary human being, to the extent that one can also be a Republican congressman and be a normal human, like something like a normal human being. So this is the situation in some ways that I described last week, where there are just enough moderates to absolutely prevent a conservative from becoming speaker, and also just enough conservatives, conservative hardliners, to absolutely prevent a moderate from becoming speaker. And it's a lot like the end of Reservoir Dogs, where everybody's just standing in a circle, pointing their guns at each other.
The Suderman bingo score on this answer is wow.
And I am not, I wish I could take credit for this idea, but so I'm not the first person to say this, but if you think about what they are in, it's a Mexican standoff.
How ironic, since they hate Mexicans.
Indeed.
Right?
Indeed. Yeah.
All right. Let's get to our end of podcast, what we've all been consuming. Before we get into the dreary perennial arguments between Peter Suderman and Nick Gillespie over the filmography of Martin
Scorsese. It's been years since we've had this argument.
It's been since whenever The Irishman came out.
And you guys actually found a way to bring it up at least once since then, apropos
correct.
Of not much. So let's go to Catherine first. What did you consume? You told us already, but what does it mean?
Yeah, I went to the National Museum of Asian Art, I went there for a couple of reasons. One, there is not one single child in that museum. And so I wanted a museum experience free from like crunched up goldfish crackers, which is still far too often my museum experience.
Is that because of falling fertility rates in Japan?
Probably, yeah. But also because it's a beautiful museum that has a wonderful collection. And what I would like to highlight specifically is a single display case, which contained maybe the coolest physical object I have seen in a while. This is a knife, one of what were originally four blades, the only one known to survive, carved for the Mughal emperor, a 16th century Mughal emperor, from a meteorite that fell in his imperial territory. First of all, it just looked cool. It was like a cool looking knife in this case. Second, like, whomst among us does not need this knife in their D&D campaign? Like, this is, you know, we got to go find the other three blades. And when they come together, something cool is going to happen. So I recommend to you the quiet and beautiful Asian Art Museum, the National Museum of Asian Art. Also of interest there, obviously, as I mentioned earlier, some of the kind of trade and art and cultural back and forth in the Middle East is captured in some displays in that museum. And I learned, maybe for the first time, what incense actually is. I'm not sure I had ever really thought a lot about that, but there was like a little Yemen propaganda exhibit. And it turns out Yemen's main thing, like in terms of trade routes and stuff, is they got that frankincense and myrrh. And you get that by just like poking a hole in a tree and then some goo comes out and then you burn it. So anyway, that's what incense is, in case anyone wondered. I did not know before now.
Who is new?
Is the Middle East part of Asia in the context of?
In the context of this museum, it is.
All right, let's get to our featured bout of the evening. Nick, why don't you go first? Why is Killers of the Flower Moon yet another terrible Martin Scorsese movie?
Because it is at least an hour too long. And I'm talking about the book and the incident that it's based on is fascinating and is worth knowing about and recounting. But as a movie, it starts in the theater with a plea from Martin Scorsese to recognize that, you know, you're seeing it in the movies, and that's really important, and that we did a really good job of, you know, making sure that all of the Native Americans depicted within are happy with it. It's strange. Like, when the director shows up before the movie and basically is saying, like, this is real, so don't criticize it or whatever, but it's just a relentlessly flat, unmotivated drama. And the main character ostensibly is Leonardo DiCaprio, who's 20 years too old for the role and there's no clear motivation. There's no growth. There's no drama throughout any of this. It's also got a terrible Robbie Robertson soundtrack, Matt. I've been listening you on this, but it is it's a relentlessly flat and uninteresting story that goes on for too long. You're much better off reading the book or actually even reading accounts on Wikipedia and on the FBI's homepage. And I can't believe I'm recommending people go to the FBI to read the story behind the actual setup of all of this, which is one more nail in the coffin for Oklahoma. Oklahoma, you know, has a great musical named after it. And then after that, virtually everything that is set in Oklahoma is an advertisement to say, do not go to Oklahoma.
Those are reservation dogs, fighting words. Suderman, what's the case for?
Well, I think the farmer and the cowman will not be friends here.
What about the oil man?
No, it's a good movie. It has some issues. I do agree that it's a little bit too long, and it has some script issues, especially in the first 70 to 90 minutes or so, where it does start I agree, it starts a little bit slow, but it draws some real power from its length, right? It forces you to consider the story that it is telling. And I think Nick's point about the characters being unmotivated is interesting, because in fact, this is something that Scorsese has been dealing with and trying to reckon with for a very long time, going certainly back to Taxi Driver and Raging Bull, but even in Goodfellas, which this movie resembles really quite surprisingly. I did not expect how many echoes of Goodfellas there would be in this work. And what Scorsese is doing is trying to ask the question of why there is sin and evil in men's hearts, because it doesn't always make sense. It's not always clearly motivated. Sometimes it's easy, obvious motivations like greed, like a desire to or just like being a crazy person, right? Like, sometimes it's easy and sometimes it's clear. But what Scorsese is drawn to are these people who do not seem to be evil in the conventional sense, and who do not seem to have some obvious motivating reason. Instead, what they have inside them is a darkness. And it's a very sort of Catholic, you know, sort of all is fallen in the world worldview from a guy whose alternative profession was that he was going to be a priest. And so this is a movie about sin and about American sin in particular, and about the ways that our country is in some sense, in at least in Scorsese's worldview, founded on a kind of sin, on venality, on criminality, on schemers, on people who do bad things. And sometimes we know why, but sometimes we just don't. And evil is a mystery, and it is. And Scorsese is our greatest chronicler of the idea that evil cannot always be fully explained, that sometimes it's just part of us and part of our hearts.
If I may, just from a cinematic point of view, the difference between Goodfellas and this is that at the center of Goodfellas, you have a character who is the person that we are wondering about, the Henry Hill character played by Ray Liotta. In this movie, there's none of that. The most interesting characters, besides the Native Americans, and particularly the what would be the female lead, who is given virtually no interior thought or motivation or anything like that, it is the Robert De Niro character, who has a kind of a teleology of, you know, why he deserves everything that he can take from the Indians. That's kind of interesting. But I think, again, what you were saying, Peter, that's an interesting world to examine. I don't see that playing out in this at all. All I see is a dull movie with unmotivated characters and an uncomplicated script, particularly because at the center of the movie, there's a hole in better Scorsese movies. There's a character there who we can kind of follow through and understand a little bit.
I would just say that interiority is something that Scorsese is constantly kind of, he doesn't reject the idea of it, but what he says is it's actually very difficult to access it, even when you seem to have access to it. And going back to Taxi Driver, a movie where you have the character displaying his thoughts, you know, in a kind of voiceover, part of the point of that movie is that you can't know why he's doing what he's doing and what motivates him to his rage, that it is simply
a part
of who he is.
You understand his rage, though. I mean, we could go on, but I would say, like, in the better Scorsese movies, and he now to me is in the Bruce Springsteen category, where I was never a big fan of his, but his earlier work is clearly much better than his later work because he is at least trying to convey all of that.
I will say Goodfellas, the thing about it is, as you, there was never a boring minute. I haven't seen Killers of the Flower Moon yet, and it seems long. But I haven't heard a description yet in which someone made the argument that there was never a boring minute in that. The pace in Goodfellas is astonishing. I am going to recommend, as a way to break the tie, although it doesn't, the female lead of Killers of the Flower Moon is Lily Gladstone. Actress, Native American actress, but not just, as if that is a diminishing category or something, but I saw a film, in which she's not just the lead, but I think is on screen every second or close to it, every minute. It's at a festival playing in New York. It's called, Fancy Dance. And it is a very small, like, Sundance-y drama. And it's phenomenal. It's a terrific, terrific small picture. If you like the show Reservation Dogs, which is about it's Sterling Harjo, three-season thing that just recently wrapped up, and I've only seen bits of it, but it's just great and filled with sort of humor and quirkiness, and told from the perspective of people on the reservation in Oklahoma. But it is just from a point of view of asserting that this is just, in its own ways, normal Americana, and it's has its own quirks and interests, and it's not like we're doing a Native American picture here, which makes it all kind of the more powerful. In this case, it's a drama about woman, an auntie, played by Lily Gladstone, who is astonishingly great in this. It reminds me of sort of the Burt Reynolds or Steve McQueen type of 70s characters who just, you cannot look away. Or Richard Dreyfuss, as I mentioned last week, just like you want to see everything this person, this actor does on the screen. But she's playing the auntie of a young girl, 12, 13, who has just lost her mom, who is the auntie's sister. The mom has been a stripper and living on the margins and has disappeared. And it's assumed that she's dead, but they're not sure. And the auntie is a fallen character, to put it mildly. She's engaged in all kinds of petty thefts and not so petty thefts and different things in her life. And it's about her attempt to kind of guard her sister, navigate through the legal systems badly, about custody over the kid, while also trying and conducting kind of an investigation, in many ways, leading an investigation, despite all the official channels being useless, of to where what happened to her sister. And it's just really great. Fancy Dance, it's called. Lily Gladstone is astonishing. I know there's been a lot of talk about her performance in Killers of the Flower Moon, which I have not seen, but I would suggest this is one of the best acting performances I've ever seen in this thing. So check it out when it comes to screen near you, if and when it does. And also, it is not 3.5 hours long. I appreciate the movie clocking in at movie length. I think that's also important. All right, we've just clocked in at podcast length, about 1 hour here. So let us go to see Nick. Is there still space available for tonight's event? There's very little daylight in between this thing posting and your event, your Reason Speakeasy happening, but do you care to tease us up,
Matt? Not unlike America, there vis-a-vis Palestinian refugees, there is no room left tonight.
Oh my god,
sold out.
There you go. Well, thanks for getting me, sneaking me in the deadline.
Well, say about that, Matt. You know, I'm checking with Ron DeSantis to see if you're allowed. But go to reason.com/events for all future events as they unfold.
Very good. And go to all of our podcasts, including the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie and also the Soho Forum debate series with Dr. Gene Epstein.
Master go to reason.com.
It's important to keep fact checking a joke, Nick, until it dies.
No, you know, I'm just saying degree inflation is a real problem, Matt. Too many people are going to master's programs.
Reason.com podcast gets you there. Reason.com donate gets you a way to give us money to make more podcasts and do more cool stuff. All right. Thank you for listening, and we will catch you again next week. Goodbye.